Hello? I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Nick. It's time to begin Tech National. The TechNet's been around for 34 years. Started in September of 1982. And we believe this particular net might be a record holder for the greatest number of nets under essentially one leadership, and maybe the greatest number of total hours, well over 5,000 hours worth of TechNets are recorded. And if somebody who wants to listen to the past recordings of TechNet, you can go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Wait a minute. Amateur Radio, not Tango Victor. Amateur Radio dot Tango Victor. And there you'll find the last 10 years of the TechNet recorded. You select the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back all the TechNet. Some of the earlier ones were even cross-referenced as to what subject was being discussed every 10 minutes. That became a little bit too excessive for Mike number one, Mike Perry, KC2NJI, who runs that particular net. Good job. That particular website, I should have said. Another website is by Mike number two, K1MJN, Mike Julian Mike. And he's at limarktechnet.com. And there you'll find other supporting information, photographs, articles, graphs, and things like that, with reference to the TechNet. You guys have heard me say it a thousand times. The main purpose of the TechNet is education. We amateurs gather on Sunday night for the last 34 years and educate each other. Where the curious amateurs gather, because they are the ones that want to know about how their radio equipment works, how to make it work better, how does propagation work, how does that radio signal get through the air? A couple of watts of signal put into an antenna, and in theory you can talk to a person thousands of miles away. It's a lot of action at a distance. You're moving the loudspeaker on his radio from thousands of miles away. How does that happen? Not easy to understand that one. But there were 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM ham radio repeater work, what you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. Try one of the 25 other kinds of ham radio before you give up this very educational hobby. John, Paul, and I, and sometimes Hal, have a rather loose schedule we follow, where for the first hour we take people who check in who do have questions or comments. You need not check in because you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. Also by way of Echolink and IRLP, we have people listening from quite a few states, quite a few countries, and sometimes they check in. The very loose schedule that we follow is that approximately the first hour, we take people who check in that do have a question or a comment, and we take those in order. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag. So for people who don't have the right equipment or the right license yet, and they want their ham radio question answered, they communicate with John, and he selects a few of those, and we discuss them next. John has sometimes gotten as many as 78 mailbag requests in the same week, so he's a popular guy. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, a space expert, who tells us the latest on what NASA and ESA and all the other space agencies, what are they doing, and there's some exciting things that have happened in the last week that you'll be hearing about. Along the way, sometimes Pal, K6DPZ, who claims to have the most brief answers, gives us the results of his years of experience with ham radio and radio electronics in general. Now, one of the messages that I said last week, has to be repeated, I think, every month or so, is that when you sit and listen to the TechNet, sometimes you'll hear pretty deep subjects. In other words, some people will check in with answers that they have from their personal experience, which gets pretty deep into the various stages of science and physics and radio. So that's a little bit putting off for some people. We have to keep repeating. think the message is that we have a philosophy on the TechNet. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The person who doesn't quite understand enough about what he's asking to even word the question correctly. If you think about it, that's the guy most deserving of an answer. The distance between what he knows and what he would like to know is the greatest. He needs an answer more than anybody else. We claim we don't have a sleepy attitude of, hey, that question doesn't come up to our level, we're not going to handle it. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are, in general, subjects of interest to ham radio operators. That includes a pretty wide field. From my point of view, a curious ham radio operator is one who's got a scientist inside that's trying to get out, if you know what I mean. So he's interested in astrophysics, astronomy, biology, chemistry, radio, electronics, transistors, integrated circuits, and so on. It goes on and on. And occasionally, subjects even a little bit into the medical field. So there are very few subjects that are inappropriate for the TechNet. We don't get into politics, obviously. That's one of many subjects. We don't get into religion. But other than that, almost anything can be asked. But the fact that you think you've got a too simple question, a too dumb question, don't let that restrict you. So, as I said before, some of those are the most needy questions as far as an answer is concerned. You'll notice that when you leave the right amount of pause between the last transmission and when you squeeze your mic, when you leave the right amount of pause, you will hear four beeps. If you jump the gun and don't look for those four beeps, there's a chance that you will time out the machine and some of what you're asking will not get heard. I listen on the input frequency, so sometimes if the person is within a reasonable number of miles of my QTH, I can hear his question, even though it doesn't get through the repeater. But you're going to give me your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful, followed by the word yes. The word yes means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign, it might sound like this, KE2BJ, Eric, and yes. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KC2WGB with the check-in update.
3-4-Y-Y, Joe, yes. John, yes.
Okay, I heard John, number one, WGB. I heard Joe, RYY. And there was a second John who got covered up. Who was the other John? Give me your call letters, sir.
KD2IXP.
Okay, IXP, John. So we've got John, Joe, and John. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
Whiskey Bravo 2, America Hotel, Kilowatt. Check. Yes.
America Hotel, Kilowatt. Yes, we got you. And one last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Kilo Delta 2, Kilo November Hotel, Charlie.
Kilo Delta 2, Kilo November Hotel, Charlie, we got you. And one last call, anyone else? K2RIW. We got more than enough to get going. So, Don, you don't often check into the TechNet as a sign in the beginning. And are we gonna put the mailbag a little earlier tonight? I'm having some fun with him. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John, number one.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick. No, I have docked DET is with Rich, N2EO, and Richie would like to check in. I think you have to give him a little time because he's probably going to come in on Echolink, but that's the bit I have. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. N2EO, are you checking in? K2IW listening for you. Okay, didn't hear Rich in there that time. But maybe he's signing in by way of, let's see now. John also maintains the monitors, the chat room, the Echo Link files, and so on. So maybe N2EO will be checking in by some other way. Okay, Joe, KWHRYY, what's the latest in your room? KWHRYY, KWHRYW in the TechNet.
Wasn't there somebody that checked in before me? I was trying to listen to myself, and somebody like stepped on top of me. I thought they were first.
Now that was already handled, and you didn't wait for the four beeps. WHRYY Watch is going to wait for the four beeps. KWHRYY Joe.
Okay, I wish the timer was 3 minutes instead of 90 seconds, but anyway, you talked about antennas being resonant and if they work good for transmit, not resonant for transmit by a certain factor of, say, it has 10% reflected power, give or take. And that'll cause the thing to be about the antenna to be about a half a dB down in radiated signal than what it would be if it was tuned as best as possible. And if it was 20% or 21%, that'd be like 1 dB down, and so forth. 63%, something like 2 dB down. But does a receiving antenna used for the same purpose work the same way? Is it a reciprocal type of operation where if an antenna is not resonant or as resonant as possible, does it work the same way of receiving as far as the efficiency goes?
Absolutely, Joe, with one catch. Based on the assumption your transmitter is a signal generator with a 50 ohm impedance, quite often they're not, and based on the assumption your receiver is a pure 50 ohm load to that antenna, if you get by those two assumptions, then you are into one of the strongest laws of antennas, the law of reciprocity. However an antenna behaves on transmit, efficiency, reflected power, pattern, side lobe levels, front to back ratio, all of the characteristics, polarization, all the power characteristics you can measure with an antenna in the transmit mode, with those two exceptions I just mentioned, you will get the exact same efficiencies and characteristics and patterns in the receive mode. You're about to ask. In the case of a mismatched antenna, an antenna with a high standing wave ratio, which means a certain percentage of the power you send into the antenna doesn't get accepted, it gets reflected back. And in many cases, when it gets reflected back, it gets lost somewhere in the feed line or the transmitter or whatever. And if you're using an antenna tuner in the low enough loss feed line, the power reflected back toward the shack gets re-reflected forward by your antenna tuner when it's properly set up, and so the power does ultimately get radiated. So in the case of a mismatched antenna, we know there's going to be a certain reflection characteristic on its transmit power. In the receive mode, it doesn't work quite the same way. The antenna, when it's properly tuned, is a good impedance match between your electronics, your feed line, that antenna, and free space. It's got a good impedance match to free space, 377 ohms per square. When your antenna has standing wave ratio, that's let's say a 2 to 1, where it's going to lose half a dB of its power, 10% of its power, what really happens is the signal coming from space, hitting your antenna, doesn't see 377 ohms, it sees a 2 to 1 standing wave ratio. It might see 700 ohms instead of 377 ohms, so to speak. Therefore, some of that power that was dedicated to be absorbed by the antenna gets re-reflected back into space. Let me drop. And that happens to be an experiment that I actually did. I was using a so-called instrumentation radar. This was a highly equipped Ku-band radar at 15 gigahertz. And I was putting various targets in front of that radar and looking at the amount of radar echo. Well, one of the targets I put in front of the antenna, instrumentation radar, was an antenna. And sure enough, as you detune the antenna so that it creates a standing wave ratio, I'm not talking about the antenna on the instrumentation radar, I'm saying a target antenna. As I detuned the target antenna, I could see the amount of echo power off that antenna changing. And so I could see the energy that was dedicated to be received by the antenna really get reflected back into space. I saw it in a real experiment that I did. Let me drop. Now, the most important seven words in the English language, in my opinion, if you are an antenna designer, the most important seven words are, you resonate first, then it will radiate. Resonance is extremely important. If you look at the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, 1985, Bell Labs, took various lengths of antennas of various diameters and really measured the real impedance. No calculations, no analysis program where he thought he had calculated the impedance. He really measured the real impedance, Mr. Brown and Woodward. And you can see the Brown and Woodward curves by going to either of the websites, amateurradio.tangovictor or limontechnet.com. In either case, you will find the Brown and Woodward curves. In some cases, it's under the article of KQLIW, how to get perfect impedance match with antenna. When you look at those curves, one of those graphs is the resistive component of impedance versus antenna length for various diameters. There's various lines on that graph for various diameters of wire of the antenna. The horizontal axis is length of antenna, the vertical axis is the resistive component of impedance. And you'll see how the resistive component goes up or down from, let's call it 70 ohms. A pure dipole at a reasonable diameter wire, exactly halfway in length long, is roughly a 73 ohm impedance. Let me drop.
The quickie answers.
You make the antenna smaller, and it will have less than 73 ohms. You make it longer than the resonant length, you'll have greater than 73 ohms. But you'll see the slope of the curve of resistive component versus length, and you'll see the resistive component change. The second graph is the reactive component. When the antenna is too long, it acts like an inductor. When it's too short, it acts like a capacitor. So the reactance is positive or negative. Positive means inductor, negative means reactive. And you look at the second curve of the Woodward curve, and you'll see that as you make the length too long or too short, there is an extremely sharp slope of change in reactance versus length. That reactance curve has got about a 10 times higher slope to it. As you make the length wrong, the reactance builds up 10 times faster. The reactive error in impedance builds up 10 times faster than the resistive error in impedance. That's the main reason why you resonate first, then it will radiate. Because if it is a non-resonant length, let me drop. If the antenna is not the right length to be resonant at your favorite frequency, and it gives you a very high reactance, there's a double error there. Not only does reactance build up real fast, but reactance gives you this one faster than resistive error. If I had, if I added 50 ohms of inductive reactance to my antenna, which is normally a 50 ohm antenna, but I had 50 ohms of inductive reactance because I've done something wrong, and I compare that to adding 50 extra ohms of resistance because I did something wrong, the crazy way that the standing wave ratio behaves, the same number of ohms of error of reactance builds up standing wave ratio faster than the same number of ohms of resistance. So you get a double error if the length is wrong. You build up reactance 10 times faster, and the reactance is more detrimental. Therefore, you will resonate the antenna. Electronically resonate. Let me drop.
CPC with the quickie answers.
Okay, please let me finish my statement first, and then I'll give you a quickie answer. So, you resonate first, meaning the right electrical length. Mechanically, you can make the antenna shorter by using loading coils, top hat capacitors, zigzagging it, helical winding it, and so on. But electronically, it must resonate if you want it to radiate well, if you want to get a good impedance match. Resonate first, then it can radiate. Now you know where that comes from, why it's so important, and you can take the ugliest looking antenna in the world at the wrong length, the wrong position, and so on, tucked in the corner of your piece of electronics, and if it's electronically resonant, it stands a good chance of doing a good job of radiating. The original question that Joe asked, well, you already heard what his question was, so if you're going to give an answer to his question in more brief terms, what would you have said, Hal, K60PZ? is. KQLAW in the TechNet.
W. Can I ask you a question, Dick? You took so much time. What was the thing that you were asked? So I can give a quickie answer, but I can't give a quickie answer if I don't know. KQRIW, K6DPZ, somewhere on Long Island.
As I've said a number of times, Hal, you've got to listen to the question first before you can give a quickie answer. Otherwise, how do you know you've got a quickie answer if you don't know what the question is? His original question was, if the antenna has standing wave ratio, and before you know it's going to have some reflective power on transmit, and now you're using that exact same antenna on receive, where does the reflective power go? That was his original question, K6DPZ, with the brief answer on that, K2LAW.
WK6DPZ. Okay, being that there's reflected power and transmit, in receive, there'd be a certain amount of characteristic loss. So the feed line would have a little bit of attenuation because of the mismatch of reflected power. Go ahead, Dick. Quickie answer. Bye-bye.
It is so quick that I strongly disagree with it. The amount of insertion loss of the feed line does not change because you're using the antenna in the transmit mode versus the receive mode. The transmission line has the exact same amount of insertion loss in both modes. Therefore, I disagree with that answer. It is so brief, I don't think it's accurate. Over to you, Hal, for a rebuttal.
W, K6DPZ. Now, let's discuss this. I'll explain to you why I'm right. Okay, first of all, the antenna we're talking about has an output impedance of 50 ohms. The receiver that's using, hypothetically, has an input impedance of 50 ohms. Now, if there is a mismatch, you're going to have a loss through the cable. Go ahead, Dan. Bye-bye.
You're going to have loss in the cable because of the mismatch. The amount of loss in the cable because of the mismatch is the same whether you're transmitting or receiving. That doesn't explain where the power, where the reflected power goes in the receive mode. I gave that answer earlier. Over to you, Hal.
It cannot be dissipated heat. We're not talking about power, we're talking about microvolts of power, okay? But there is a loss because of an inherent mismatch. Roger?
If I take a well-tuned antenna and I detune it so that it has 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, which means it's going to have half a dB of loss. In the case of transmitting, the half a dB of loss represents the power reflected by the antenna back towards the transmitter. In the receive mode, it still has half a dB of insertion loss. Who cares if it's microwatts? Microwatts or kilowatts? Microvolts. It still has half a dB of loss in the receive mode. Joe's original question was the half a dB of loss, the 2-to-1 Biswark, in the receive mode. The reflected, the loss of power, half a dB, where did it go? Over to you, Hal, K2LAW.
All right, W, KCC, I got a phone call on cell. Dick, I'd love to sit here and work this over with you, but at the moment, I got to answer a phone call. I do have a lot.
Lots of dropout, but I've already discussed that. The people listening earlier heard the answer. And you know, I wonder if it makes sense to you. So you can have a standing wave ratio of 700 ohms instead of 377 ohms of free space in the receive mode because of the Biswar of your antenna. The power gets re-reflected back into space. You don't see it, but you get the exact same half a dB of loss. That is the law of reciprocity. To me, to YY, darn good question, Joe. And you'd be amazed how many people have argued this one till the cows come home and don't always agree, as you can hear tonight. To be to RYY?
Okay, Junior.
Eric goes first and then pass it over to Joe. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but I believe you left one little thing out, where you asked about the performance of the antenna. And as you well know, you've got that loss. Also, the noise dropped by that equal amount. So as far as the dynamic range of the receiver goes, the signal noise ratio of that received signal stays the same.
A very good answer, Eric, except that there's even a slight BS on that. On HF frequencies, you're right. You create some extra loss in the antenna due to BISLAW, feed line, or whatever, because the noise on HF frequencies is so high, you get less signal, you get less noise, and the signal-to-noise ratio stays the same. At UHF frequencies, that ain't true. At UHF frequencies, the major noise you're dealing with, in some cases, is the noise figure of your own receiver, which is essentially constant, so that when you make a mistimed antenna, which is going to give you less signal, at UHF frequencies, that less signal is beating against the same amount of noise coming from your receiver, therefore your signal-to-noise ratio does degrade due to this factor. I wonder if you agree with that one, Eric. KE2EG, you're a UHF person. K2EW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was making the assumption that we were talking about HF. It's different as we get beyond 50 megahertz, so, you know, I agree with you. The biggest banger as far as UHF and above is, as you said, is receiver noise, what you are generating thermally with the receiver. But if you were, say, we were going to make that measurement at some high level, I think you'll still find the absolute noise figure. If the noise level was, say, greater than the that window of distance would still be similar until you finally hit the noise floor of the receiver. So, I mean, even though way up there is different because of the amount of gain, the amount of conversion that you're creating, the stages that make their own noise. As far as the antenna is concerned, it's still the same rule. It doesn't really change. K2IW and K2IW.
AC2IS query?
AC2IS. K2IW. I think that's Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bill, AC2IS over here. And I had a question about, it sounded like you said that if there's an impedance mismatch, I assume between a feed line and an antenna, it sounded as if this would result in a perceived impedance mismatch between the antenna and free space. Are those two variables related? That's the question. AC2IS.
They sure are, Bill. It's good you asked that question. We all forget about the fact that free space, to some degree, acts like an ethereal, ephemeral, call it what you like, flimsy signal generator that has an impedance of 377 ohms per square. When you build a good antenna that has a good impedance match at your end of the antenna, the 50 ohm transmission line, so to speak, the antenna really is an electromagnetic transducer. That's a fancy way of saying it takes the electronic signal from your transmitter that's conveyed by your transmission line down to the antenna, converts it into an electromagnetic wave, gives it the right magnetic field, E field, polarization, temporal response. The antenna transfers your electronic signal from the cable and makes it amenable to that free space. It does create an impedance match to free space, 377 ohms. Hard to believe, but they're taking place in both directions when you transmit or when you receive. You do something that mismatches the antenna. Your end of the antenna in the shack, you sense it as standing wave radio. I personally, as I told you earlier, use an instrumentation radar where I was looking at the echo created by an antenna that was sitting in front of my radar as a target. Let me drop the phone. Every antenna, by the way, has echo. No matter how impedance matched it is, a perfectly matched dipole in free space of all the energy that hits it. If the dipole is perfectly impedance matched, half of that energy goes down the transmission line, the other half gets re-radiated into space. So if you're holding a dipole in front of your instrumentation radar, and you look at the echo, and there's always an echo, and now you mismatch the dipole, you will see the echo get stronger. That's a strong piece of evidence that the free space wave hit that antenna. It saw the 2-to-1 standard wave ratio instead of 377. Maybe it saw 700 ohms, as an example. and so a greater percentage of the energy hitting the antenna gets re-reflected. I personally made that measurement. I saw that result. I gave it that interpretation. So you can get an impedance match on either end of the antenna. You get the exact same amount of mismatch. If the antenna is a 2-to-1 Zwillinger measured on a lossless piece of transmission line, by definition, it is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio as far as its coupling into free space, the 377 ohms. Ain't that crazy? Very few books will say that. AC2IS, I bet you had a little trouble swallowing the first time here. AC2IS, K2IW, you got it, Bill?
Yeah, I am having a little difficulty with this. I'm thinking, like, okay, in theory, if you have an antenna that's perfectly impedance matched to free space, 377 ohms, and then you do something to cause a mismatch between your feed line and the antenna, that's at the other end of the same antenna, and you get a reflection there, how do you know that, I mean, you're not, in your experiment, how do you know that you're not just remeasuring that reflection between the antenna and the feed line, and maybe the impedance match between the antenna and free space is still perfect, AC2IS?
The antenna in question had a 50-ohm transmission line connected to it into a perfect, in theory, 50-ohm dummy load. So as far as the signal that got launched from the antenna, the antenna is being used in the receive mode. In the receive mode, every antenna has a calculatable amount of effective capture area. It captures a certain amount of that signal from free space that hit your antenna. By the way, a dipole at 8 meters has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. It's hard to believe it's that big, even though it's made out of 16-inch diameter, 14-gauge wire, 130 feet long. The wire of your dipole antenna casts a shadow on the ground of 1 square foot. Electronically, radio-wise, at the resonant frequency, 80 meters, 3.7 megacycles. There's various ways you can measure the effective capture area of that antenna, and it is 8,500 square feet. It's a great big black hole in space around that wire because of resonance. Okay. So you make that dipole on 80 meters, too long or too short, so it's got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Some of the signal the antenna tries to pick up doesn't get launched into your 50-ohm cable. You see it as a half a dB of loss. If you are using an instrumentation radar, assuming there was one at 3.7 megacycles, and you were aiming a signal at the antenna, and you looked at the amount of echo when it was perfectly impedance matched, and then when it's not too long or too short, it's not properly impedance matched, you will see the amount of echo from the antenna in free space increasing. It didn't suck up all that signal. Its effective capture area decreased. So your antenna is an impedance matching device which works in both directions. Let me drop it. When you're transmitting, that antenna, as an electromagnetic transducer, takes your 50-ohm signal on your 50-ohm transmission line, so to speak, converts it to a signal radiated in space, and the signal radiated in space by that dipole looks like a 377-ohm impedance to free space. When you're receiving the 377 ohms of free space, hit your dipole, and if the dipole is acting like 377 ohms, the maximum amount of signal is now going to be absorbed from free space because of its effective capture area and sent down your transmission line. So it's an impedance matching device in both directions. When transmitting, it's impedance matching from 50 to 377. When you're receiving, it's impedance matching from 377 to 50. It's a little bit like a transformer with about a 6-to-1 or whatever it is turns ratio. Ain't that crazy, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's still a little bit difficult for me to wrap my head around here. I'm thinking if your antenna has to resonate, you know, it's got a Q factor, so depending on its Q factor, it's, you know, radiating to free space, maybe 10%, 20%, maybe, of the energy that's in the antenna. so it doesn't, that there's, you know, there's a reflection, so there's necessarily not a perfect impedance match between free space. If there were a perfect impedance match, would there not be no resonance because all energy would just head directly out into free space?
You said some very logical sounding things, Bill, but there's a couple of errors there. If your antenna is made out of low loss materials, of all the power you put into it, essentially 100% of it is good. 100% of it is radiated into free space. You put 100 watts into that dipole, 99 or 98 watts is going to be radiated into free space if you've made it out of low loss materials. So it doesn't have resistive loss efficiency. It has standing wave ratio inefficiency. You make the dipole too long or too short, so it's non-resonant, so it has a high standing wave ratio. When you're transmitting, a certain amount of power from your feed line doesn't get accepted by the antenna. Gets re-reflected back toward your transmitter. When you're receiving, the dipole is trying to some other impedance. So some of the signal coming free space tries to hit your dipole, gets reflected right at that interface in free space. Now, if the dipole is resonant, simplistically you'd like to believe of all the power you put on your transmission line hitting your dipole, you'd like to believe that the power comes out of your transmission line, hits the dipole, and this just jumps into space. Absolutely not. Radiation is difficult. You've got to kick that signal in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally gets radiated. The first time your signal travels down that dipole, roughly 10% of it gets radiated. 90% is left over when the signal comes down to the tips of the dipole, it's re-reflected back. The signal bounces back and forth on your dipole 10 times before it gets radiated. A second definition of resonance is that you want to make sure all of those bounces, those 10 bounces, so to speak, stay co-phase, stay in step with each other. That's one of the definitions of resonance.
Repeater, time out.
You make the dipole too long, and those bounce signals come. The bounce signals come back with a time delay. They come back out of phase. Make it too short, they come back too soon. So the signal's going to bounce back and forth. That's some of the mechanism going on inside the dipole. But the power you put into the dipole, ultimately, if you made it out of low loss materials, essentially 100% of it gets radiated by this complicated process of the signal bouncing back and forth. Very few books make that clear. They tell you there's a standing wave structure. In the hidden language of the word standing wave structure, you know the signal is bouncing back and forth. That's what standing wave is. But very few people get down to the nitty-gritty of the dipole has a signal with a Q of 10, and you prove it's got a Q of 10 by measuring its bandwidth, dividing it into the center frequency, and you'll get roughly 10 on a dipole of a reasonable diameter of wire, if you know what I mean. So within all of these fine details of the signal bouncing back and forth, still, ultimately, a certain amount of signal is reflected from the antenna. If there's a mismatch when you're transmitting, a certain amount of signal is reflected back into space, never got into the antenna in the first place, if there was a mismatch in the antenna. Those two amounts of loss are identical. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at 50 ohms is also a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio at 377 ohms. AC2IS, K2RIW. I know you're going to have to hear this a number of times before it makes sense, Bill. Over to you, Bill.
Yeah, I don't think there's enough time for that tonight, but
KD2KZG, this is my first time on this net. Is this representative of the extent of the net? Are I talking about antennas, or will we be talking about other things?
Mr. KZG, the TechNet has existed for 34 years. In 34 years, we've probably discussed many thousands of subjects. Occasionally, we get into antennas. Arguably, the antenna is the most important part of a ham radio setup. Occasionally, we get pretty deep into it. And we're not forcing you to listen to it. We don't always go this deep. The person asks the question of this nature. The other people are contributing information and further questions. Wanted more information about the antenna. So therefore, Mr. KZG, you're not on the list of people who signed in the beginning. So we're not keeping you waiting as far as people who are wanting an answer. ACQIS, go ahead, Bill. K2RIW.
I got a comment on reciprocity when you guys get a chance, by the way, Dick. WY2U.
Okay. And I want to hear from you, Mike, WY2U. But as you can tell, Mr. KZG thinks we're on this up too long, and he wants us to move on. There are people really asking questions, making contributions, and therefore this is a subject that should be discussed because it's most highly misunderstood amongst most radio people. What really goes on inside of an antenna is highly misunderstood because the classes we take do not teach it. If you were in Mike's class at his college, I guarantee he does a much better job. Why don't you go over right now, Mike? WY2U, when you're trying to teach your students how an antenna works, I bet you it ain't easy, and I bet you they don't all jump onto the concept and walk out of the room whistling the tune right away. What really goes on in the RF world is a little complicated, I think. But maybe you found a way of making it simpler, Mike. WY2U. Professor Mike, KTRIW, you got a mic.
No, I'm afraid not. The first time I introduced some of the basic concepts of the antenna and how the antenna systems work, most of those guys want to run out of the class naked screaming. So, on the contrary. But I do have a comment on reciprocity, which I think is kind of interesting. As you correctly pointed out, and I just want to reiterate this from Joe, an antenna in the transmit position will have just about every property identically the same in both transmit and receive, which includes gain, directivity, impedance mismatch or lack of mismatch on a transmission line. But the one thing that it does not have, and I found this interesting because this comes right out of Krauss's book, and I'll be darned if I can find the page where it is. Let me drop a second. The one parameter that is not reciprocal, and this is interesting because you have to go through the math to find out what it really means. The one property of an antenna that is not reciprocal in transmit and receive is the amplitude distribution of either current or voltage. Let's take a resonant half-wave antenna with a sinusoidal excitation on the transmit side. The current and or voltage on the antenna distribution will resemble a half a sine wave, and that is absolutely correct. Now, in the receives situation, however, the current and voltage distribution is entirely different because usually the antenna is in the far field. And by that time, the wave is now a plane wave, which means every point along that antenna sees an equal electric field or an equal magnetic field, which is not cosinusoidal anymore. The math actually sorts things out when the antenna has a transducer, reconverts it back into a voltage and a current. But it's kind of interesting to realize that in the receive mode, you have a uniform field across the antenna, and in the transmit mode, you do not. Back to net, WY2U.
Yeah, that's a beautiful piece of information, Mike. And I've got another interpretation I'm going to toss to you. And so, when you're transmitting, you and I know for a fact, there is a sinusoidal distribution of current and voltage. The current is maximum in the center, zero at the tips. That's the current distribution, a half sine wave. The voltage distribution is maximum at the tips and essentially zero at the center when you plot it at the peak positive or the peak negative, so to speak. You get that crazy distribution because of the bouncing wave back and forth, the resonant sine wave of this reflective device. What's the word I'm looking for now? Standing wave, that's a standing wave structure. If I give you a fairly strong signal coming from free space, a thoroughly planar signal, but I now make the signal strong enough that I'm able to measure the parameters of what's going on the dipole itself. Let me drop. The signal has been there long enough. And by the way, when you've got a Q of 10, you've got a certain rise time and fall time, whether you're transmitting or receiving, it doesn't matter. When I'm transmitting, I can look at the amplitude of the signal on the dipole, and it starts off on the very first cycle at a certain amplitude, and the next cycle is a little bit bigger. It has a certain rise time on transmit. It's got the exact same rise time on receive. I suddenly turn on a signal at some very long distance, and the signal starts hitting my dipole. And if I wait long enough, the signal builds up on the dipole with the exact same rise time. Once that signal has built up on the dipole, even though the distribution of the signal in free space is linear, the amount of energy absorbed by the dipole with its resonance, with its effective capture in whatever, gives me, when a timing has gone through the rise time, the voltage distribution on the wire itself is that exact same sine wave of current and voltage that I had on transmission, just that it's now smaller unless I use a whole lot of transmit power, if you know what I mean. So, although the excitation to the dipole is linear, what really gets set up on the dipole, because of its Q, of its resonance, because it's a standing wave structure, is the exact same waveform that finally ends up on the dipole, and that's what a portion of that energy with that crazy distribution goes down my transmission line and moves my receiver signal strength meter. I strongly believe that one, Mike. You and I might disagree on this one. WYQU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, sir. I have absolutely no disagreement. And the reason why that happens is the antenna is acting in both modes, transmit and receive, as a transducer. It is somehow converting the electrical energy, current, and voltage into a wave, a propagating wave, which has an electric component and a magnetic component. Even though the wave coming into this antenna might be a plane wave on arrival because the antenna is in the far field, due to the fact that it's a resonant transducer, just as you pointed out, it will reproduce a sinusoidal pattern, or in this case, a half sinusoidal pattern on the antenna. So no argument there. You're absolutely correct. But it is interesting to point out, though, that the actual field distribution, I'm talking about field distribution, now amplitude field distribution, in one case mimics the drive and transmit, and the other case mimics the plane wave and receive, due to the fact that electromagnetic energy and light energy both are a traveling plane wave in the far field. No disagreement there, sir. WY to you.
Yeah, so the actual waveform from free space that the dipole is receiving as its input excitation, and the way the dipole responds to it, because of its resonance, because of its finite bandwidth, because it's a standing wave structure, because it's got a certain effective capture area, what finally ends up on the dipole is the exact same waveform you would see when you're transmitting, even though the excitation from free space is this more linear thing. If I now start looking at the nearby waves in free space when I'm transmitting versus receiving, there's a definite difference, and maybe that's one of the things we're getting at, Mike. Let me drop it.
That's correct.
Eric recognized. Your dipole is almost a point source radiator. So in the near field, the signals that you transmit from the dipole look like a bunch of expanding bubbles, bubbles being inflated, or balloons being inflated. It's a spherical wave front coming off the dipole. And when you stand far enough away from the dipole, it eventually becomes a planar wave, because the bubble gets so big that when you're looking at a little portion of that surface, it looks flat to you. And when you're receiving a signal from a long distance away, that waveform near the dipole is really a planar waveform until the dipole starts interacting with it. If you're looking inches away from your dipole, from that signal coming in free space, all hell's breaking loose, if you know what I mean. So receiving and transmitting, the law of reciprocity is almost never violated. All the parameters you measure, gain, bandwidth, signal-to-noise ratio, gain, bandwidth, pattern, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, null depths, all that. All of that on transmit and receive with the right instrumentation will be identical whether you're transmitting or receiving. That's what reciprocity says. How it really comes about when you get into the fine details is something really crazy, as you can tell. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I think you just answered my question, but here we go anyway. Because I was visualizing, let's say you have because we're talking about the far field here, let's say you have a horizontally polarized antenna, and receiving a signal which is coming from the atmosphere, which is, well, let's just call it a circularly polarized signal at this point. So I would expect that the amplitude that the receiving antenna is getting will be going up and down depending upon the angle at which the wavefront is actually hitting the antenna. And that kind of signal is not planar in nature. It's moving up and down according to the polarization, is it not? KTRIWK, to again.
We have all seen these diagrams in the good books about what does the field look like in the vicinity of a dipole, in the reactive near field, in the radiating near field, in the very close proximity to the dipole. They take a snapshot at one instant of time and they try to plot for you what the E lines and the H lines look like. And it gives you a fairly complicated pattern. If your eyes operate at RF frequencies, would you see that pattern? I say no. If your eyes could select, hey, I'm tuning my eye with a set of glasses so I only see the E, I'm tuning my eyes so I only see the H, would I see something like that crazy pattern? Maybe. If my eyes are looking at total energy, and I'm looking at each individual cycle of energy coming off that dipole as being radiated into free space, when I get away from the dipole itself a couple of wavelengths, all of that energy coming out of the dipole is a perfectly spherical balloon that's being inflated. It's being inflated at the speed of light. We drop. It's my belief, Eric, that every antenna you and I have ever used, read about, studied, whatever, radiates bubbles of signal. The bubbles are perfectly round. The bubbles are perfectly round in all directions of free space. That's what each individual cycle of energy coming out of that antenna looks like. A bunch of expanding balloons or bubbles. I will admit that the bubbles are on the surface direction. That's where the main lobe of the antenna is. But the pattern that you see plotted in the books, this is the antenna pattern. This is the main lobe and the side lobe and the beam with the main lobe. That is a interesting engineering representation that tries to tell you how strong the signal in various directions. It does not tell you what the signal would look like in free space. If your eyes operated at free space and you could see radio waves, you would see expanding bubbles, perfectly round bubbles in all directions. There are people who look at that antenna pattern and assume that the signal comes off the dipole, comes off your Yagi antenna in the main lobe. You've got that particular pattern where the main lobe is nice and strong and the side lobes are nice and weak. Let me drop. That pattern has greater distance from the origin in certain directions. We call that the main lobe, the strong signal part, and weaker in other directions. There are people who make the mistake of assuming that that is a range pattern. You'd be amazed how many people I've stopped from sending out a specification for an antenna where they plotted that antenna pattern and they thought the antenna pattern represented range. They wanted the signal to go out. In that particular case, it happened to be an antenna on a handheld RFID reader. They wanted the signal to go out exactly 12 feet and then stop. In other words, they were demanding that the antenna manufacturer manufacture an antenna so that at the main lobe the signal went out 12 feet and stopped, and the signal in the other directions where the antenna pattern was smaller, they wanted the signal to go to a smaller distance and stop. They wanted the signal really to go to 12 feet and stop, and no signal beyond that point. Mother Lurch's, Mother Nature's laws of physics and inverse square law wouldn't let you do that. I tried to stop them from issuing that request for quote because it would have a whole lot of people laughing at the company if that really got out into the outside world, if you know what I mean. So lots of people misinterpret that pattern. That pattern is telling you signal strength versus direction. It does not tell you what your eye would see if you were watching those signals. If you could slow down the movie in slow motion and watch the signals coming out of the antenna, it's a bunch of expanding bubbles. KE2EJ for rebuttal. Keep your eyes on the ground, Eric.
I hear you. I definitely hear you, and I understand what you're saying, but I still have this little thing that sticks in the back of my mind. For example, it's microwave frequency, 6AU band. We can transmit two signals on the same frequency, make one horizontally polarized and one vertically polarized. So are you saying that the bubbles that are being created are essentially round, and there's no difference between the ones that I project out on a horizontal plane and the ones that I project out on a vertical plane? Because as you know, just by changing your polar order, you can separate one signal from the other. And as you know, in terms of when we get wave phase, we're not actually attenuating the signal. We're scattering the polarization of the two signals, and this makes sense. It's RWK2J.
Yeah, good question, Eric, and I've got another whole tilt on this one. If my antenna doing the radiating happens to be horizontally polarized, and I want to look at those, but my eyes are tuned to horizontally polarized signals, and I'm able to see the radio wave, and I've made it a slow motion move so I can, even though it's moving at the speed of light, I can slow it down and watch what's going on. My horizontally polarized eyes, sensing this horizontally polarized transmitting signal, will see those bubbles that are perfectly round being expanded at the speed of light coming off from the antenna, and the bubble is brighter in some directions, that's where you get the main lobe, and dimmer in some directions, that's where you get side lobes and back lobes. But the bubbles are always perfectly round. If I suddenly start tilting my eyes so that on this horizontally polarized antenna, I now start looking at the vertical polarization, the bubbles do not change in shape. They change in intensity. As I start tuning my eyes toward vertical, I will see the bubbles become very dim. I'm no longer absorbing the energy of those bubbles. The bubbles, each surface of the bubble of each particular cycle of that wave is horizontally polarized. If I mistune my detector, my receiver, so I'm only looking at vertical, I'm not going to see anything. It's going to get weaker and weaker as I go in that direction. In the case of circular polarization, as I tune my eye from horizontal to vertical, I will see no change in the intensity of the bubbles. In all cases, bubbles have got the exact same shape, the exact same diameter, expanding at the exact same rate. Let me drop this. And how bright the bubbles are to my sensing device are only a function of whether or not I am co-polarized or cross-polarized. In the case of circular polarization, it can't easily be cross-polarized, if you know what I mean, with a linear sensing antenna. Although there is another version now. If I'm transmitting a pure clockwise circular polarized wave, and if my eyes are tuned for counterclockwise, obviously I'm going to see very dim bubbles. And so it's a mistuning of the way I'm trying to intercept the signal that's coming to my eyes. The error occurs at the detector, not the transmitter, if you know what I mean. So I can decide to transmit any polarization, any elliptical polarization you like, and in theory I can tune my detector to sense that particular elliptical polarization. That only affects the brightness of the bubbles that I see. It doesn't affect their shape, it doesn't affect the rate at which they expand. All radiated signal from that antenna are perfectly round spheres expanding at the speed of light. KE2EJ, KQRIW, that's a strongly felt opinion.
All right, help me understand this a little bit. If each one of those is a bubble, okay, so let's try and imagine that let's elect that thing for a voltage. If each bubble is perfectly round, are you saying that a certain plane of the bubble has the maximum voltage? Just use voltage as an example as a witness to see this. And that on a different plane of the bubble, the voltage is less. Is that what you're trying to say?
No. Each individual bubble, the surface of the bubble, I could decide to sense the surface of the bubble where the radio signal crosses through 0 volts, or where it hits maximum volts, or maximum current. There's various ways I could tune my bubble sensing device. Let's assume that I set the bubbles for the zero crossing, but still energy is there. So the bubbles represent, the surface of the bubbles represent a certain amount of energy in that direction. Now, depending on how I radiated that signal, I can radiate the signal horizontally polarized, vertically polarized, clockwise, circular, and so on. And the energy of each bubble, each surface of the bubble, is equal to the amount of radiated signal. Now, when you and I try to detect those bubbles, I'm looking at it with my tuned eye or with my tuned receiving antenna or whatever. I now have to make my detecting device, whether it be eye or receiving antenna, I have to make it co-polarized if I want to see the maximum energy. If I create a polarization mismatch in my detecting device, it doesn't change the amount of energy radiated by the antenna. If I put 100 watts into the antenna, 100 watts is going to be radiated. Let me drop this. And if that antenna is in the middle of a spherical room, and the spherical room has an area, a surface area of 100 square meters, and I'm putting 100 watts into that antenna, by definition, the average surface of that spherical room, if it's an isotropic antenna, every surface, every portion of the surface of that spherical room would have exactly 1 watt per square meter. 100 square meters, total area, 100 watts total power, and so on. So the amount of power I put into the antenna tells me exactly how much energy is in each of those surfaces of those bubbles if it was a sphere, if it was an ISO antenna. If it's an antenna with a whole lot of gain, yes, the bubbles are and dimmer in other areas, but the energy I launch into the bubbles is strictly a function of the way I put power into that antenna and whatever antenna pattern it's got. Now, I can see less